Chapter 13. Nick opened the door between Sheriff Baker's office and the jail cells, and they started razzing him right off. Vincent Hogan and Billy Warner were in the two saltine box cells on Nick's left. Mike Childress was in one of the two on the right. The other was empty, and it was empty because Ray Booth, he of the purple LSU fraternity ring, had flown the coop.
"Hey, dummy," Childress called. "Hey, you fucking dummy. What's going to happen to you when we get out of here, huh? Answer me that. What the fuck you think's going to happen to you?" "I'm personally going to rip your balls off and stuff them down your throat until you strangle on them," Billy Warner told him. "You understand me?"
Only Vince Hogan didn't participate in the razzing. Mike and Billy didn't have too much use for him on this day, June 23rd, when they were to be taken up to the Calhoun County seat and jugged pending trial. Sheriff Baker had leaned on old Vince, and old Vince had spilled his yellow guts. Baker had told Nick he could get an indictment against these boys, but when it got to a jury trial, it was going to be Nick's word against these three. Four, if they picked up Ray Booth. Nick lowered his head so he couldn't see their lips and went on sweeping. He was careful to keep to the center of the aisle, out of reach of their hands. He had gained a healthy respect for Sheriff John Baker. At 250 pounds, he was Big John to his constituents. The respect was not just because he had given Nick this swamper's job to make up for his week's lost pay, but because he had gone after the four men who had beaten Nick up, as if the victim had been the oldest resident in town instead of a drifter passing through. There were sheriffs in the border south, Nick knew, who would have been happy to see him onto the county work farm instead. They had driven out to the sawmill where Vince Hogan worked, in Baker's private car. He had a bubble light in the glove box that he put on the dash when he was on business. It was up there when they had gone out on the morning of the 21st. Baker had hawked, spat out the window, and dabbed at his watery eyes. His voice had acquired a nasal foghorning quality, which Nick, of course, couldn't hear. "When we see him," Baker said, "I'm going to grab him by the arm. I'll ask you, is this one of them? I don't care if you saw him or not. You just nod yes. Get it?" Nick nodded. He got it. Vince was working on the board planer, standing in sawdust almost to the tops of his work boots. His eyes flicked uneasily to Nick standing beside the sheriff, and he gave Baker a nervous smile. "Hi, Big John. What you doing out with the working folk?" The other men were watching, their eyes shifting from Nick to Vince to Baker in a kind of continuous triple play. One of them spat a stream of red man into the sawdust and wiped his chin deliberately with the heel of his hand. Baker grabbed Vince by one flabby, sunburned arm and dragged him forward. "Hey," Vince said nervously. "Why you pulling on me, Big John?" Baker turned to Nick. "Is this one of them?" Nick nodded firmly and pointed at Vince. "Hey," Vince protested. "I don't know this dummy from Adam." "Then how you so sure he's a dummy? Come on, Vince. You can send one of these old boys for your toothbrush. March." Protesting, Vince had been led to the cruiser and deposited inside. He was taken back to Shoyo, locked up, and left to stew for a couple of hours. When Baker came back in around noon, Vince was hungry and scared. He had spilled everything. Mike Childress was in the jug by 1 o'clock, and Billy Warner was found at his house as he was packing up his old Ford to go somewhere. A long piece from the look of all the suitcases and cartons. Baker had taken Nick home to meet his wife and have some supper. In the car on the way over, Baker had told Nick that she was bearing up under the news that her brother Ray had been involved in the assault. "She knows you can't pick your relatives like you do your friends," he said. Jane Baker was a small, pretty woman who made Nick welcome, but her eyes were red and socketed from weeping. "I'm pleased to know you, Nick," she said, taking his hand, "and I apologize deeply for your trouble." Nick shrugged awkwardly and waved it away. "I offered him a job around the place," Baker said. "It's gone to hell since Bradley moved to Little Rock, painting and picking up mostly. He's going to have to stick around anyway for the, trial, yes," she said. There was a moment of silence, painful even to Nick. Then, with forged gaiety, she said, "I hope you can eat country ham, Nick. That's what there is, along with potato salad. My potato salad's never up to what his mother made. That's what he says. Nick patted his stomach and smiled. Over the strawberry shortcake dessert, Jane said,
You've been taking too much on, John Baker. Your cold's worse, and you didn't eat.
Baker looked guiltily at his plate, then shrugged. I can afford to miss one now and then, he said, and palpitated his double chin.
You're flush, too. Fever?
Maybe a touch.
Well, you're not going out tonight, that's all.
My dear, I have prisoners. If they don't need to be watched, they at least need to be fed and watered.
Nick can do that, she said with finality. You're going to bed.
I can't do that, he said weakly. He isn't a deputy.
Well, you just deputize him.
He ain't a resident.
I won't tell if you won't, she said firmly. She began clearing the table. You just go on and do it.
And that was how Nick Andros went from show-yo prisoner to show-yo deputy in less than 24 hours. As he was preparing to go up to the sheriff's office, Baker came into the downstairs hall, looking large and ghostly in a frayed bathrobe. He seemed a little embarrassed to be seen in such attire. I shouldn't have let her talk me into this, he said. Wouldn't have if I didn't feel so punk. My chest's all clogged up and I'm as hot as a fire sale. Weak, too. Nick nodded sympathetically. I'm stuck between deputies. Bradley Cade and his wife went up to Little Rock after their baby died. One of those crib deaths. Awful thing. I don't blame them for going. Nick pointed at his own chest and made a circle with his thumb and forefinger. Sure, you'll be okay. You just take normal care, you hear? There's a 45 in the third drawer of my desk, but don't you be taking it back there, nor the keys either, understand? If you go back there, stay out of their reach. If any of them tries playing sick, don't you fall for it. It's the oldest dodge in the world. If one of them should get sick, Doc Soames can see them just as easy in the morning. I'll be in then. Nick took his pad from his pocket and wrote, I appreciate you trusting me. Thanks for locking them up and thanks for the job. Baker read this carefully. You're a pure decaution, boy. Where are you from? How come you're out on your own like this? That's a long story, Nick jotted. But I'll write some of it down for you tonight if you want. You do that, Baker said. I guess you know I put your name on the wire. Nick nodded. It was SOP, but he was clean. I'll get Jane to call Ma's truck stop out by the highway. Those boys will be hollering police brutality if they don't get their supper. Nick wrote, Have her tell whoever brings it to come right in. I can't hear him if he knocks. Okay. Baker hesitated a moment longer. You got your cot in the corner. It's hard, but it's clean. You just remember to be careful, Nick. You can't call for help. Nick nodded and wrote, I can take care of myself. Yeah, I believe you can. Still, I'd get someone from town if I thought any of them would. He broke off as Jane came in.
You still jawing this poor boy? You let him go on now before my stupid brother comes along and breaks them all out.
Baker laughed sourly. He'll be in Tennessee by now, I guess. He whistled out a long sigh that broke up into a series of phlegmy, booming coughs. I believe I'll go upstairs and lie down, Janie.
I'll bring you some aspirin to cut that fever, she said.
She looked back over her shoulder at Nick as she went to the stairs with her husband.
It was a pleasure meeting you, Nick, whatever the circumstances. You be just as careful as he says.
Nick bowed to her, and she dropped half a curtsy.
He thought he saw a gleam of tears in her eyes.
A pimply, curious boy in a dirty busboy's jacket brought three dinner trays about half an hour after Nick had gotten down to the jail. Nick motioned for the busboy to put the trays on the cot, and while he did, Nick scribbled, Is this paid for? The busboy read this with all the concentration of a college freshman tackling Moby Dick.
Yeah, he said. Sheriff's office runs a tab. Say, can't you talk?
Nick shook his head. That's a bitch, the busboy said, and left in a hurry, as if the condition might be catching. Nick took the trays in one at a time and pushed each one through the slot in the bottom of the cell door with a broom handle. He looked up in time to catch, "Chicken shit bastard, ain't he?" from Mike Childress. Smiling, Nick showed him his middle finger. "I'll give you the finger, you dummy," Childress said, grinning unpleasantly. "When I get out of here, I'll..." Nick turned away, missing the rest. Back in the office, sitting in Baker's chair, he drew the memo pad into the center of the blotter, sat thinking for a moment, and then jotted at the top, "Life History by Nick Andros." He stopped, smiling a little. He had been in funny places, but never in his wildest dreams had he expected to be sitting in a sheriff's office, deputized, in charge of three men who had beaten him up, and writing his life story. After a moment, he began to write again. "I was born in Caslin, Nebraska, on November 14, 1958. My daddy was an independent farmer. He and my mom were always on the edge of getting squeezed out. They owed three different banks. My mother was 6 months pregnant with me, and my dad was taking her to see the doctor in town when a tie rod on his truck let go and they went into the ditch. My daddy had a heart attack and died. Anyway, 3 months after, my mom had me, and I was born the way I am. Sure was a tough break on top of losing her husband that way. She carried on with the farm until 1963, and then lost it to the big operators, as she always called them. She had no family, but wrote to some friends in Big Springs, Iowa, and one of them got her a job in a bakery. We lived here until 1967, when she was killed in an accident. A man on a motorcycle hit her while she was crossing the street on her way home from work. It wasn't even his fault, but only bad luck as his brakes failed. He wasn't even speeding or anything. The Baptist Church gave my mama a charity funeral. This same church, the Grace Baptist, sent me to the Children of Jesus Orphanage in Des Moines. This is a place that all sorts of churches chip together to support. That was where I learned to read and write." He stopped there. His hand was aching from writing so much, but that wasn't why. He felt uneasy, hot and uncomfortable at having to relive all that again. He went back to the jail quarters and looked in. Childress and Warner were asleep. Vince Hogan was standing by the bars, smoking a cigarette and looking across the corridor at the empty cell where Ray Booth would have been tonight if he hadn't run so quick. Hogan looked as if he might have been crying, and that led him back in time to that small, mute scrap of humanity, Nick Andros. There was a word he had learned at the movies as a kid. That word was incommunicado. It was a word that had always had fantastic, Lovecraftian overtones to Nick. A fearful word that echoed and clanged in the brain. A word that inscribed all the nuances of fear that live only outside the sane universe and inside the human soul. He had been incommunicado all his life. He sat down and reread the last line he'd written. "That was where I learned to read and write." But it hadn't been as simple as that. He lived in a silent world. Writing was code. Speech was the moving of lips, the rise and fall of teeth, the dance of a tongue. His mother had taught him to read lips and had taught him how to write his name in struggling, sprawling letters. "That's your name," she had said. "That's you, Nicky." But of course, she had said it silently, meaninglessly. The prime connection had come when she tapped the paper, then tapped his chest. The worst part about being deaf-mute was not living in the silent movie world. It was not knowing the names of things. He had not really begun to understand the concept of naming until he was 4. He had not known that you called the tall green things trees until he was 4. He had wanted to know, but no one had thought to tell him, and he had no way to ask. He was incommunicado. When she died, he had retreated almost all the way. The orphanage was a place of roaring silence where grim-faced, thin boys made fun of his silence. Two boys would run up to him, one boy with his hands plastered over his mouth, one boy with his hands plastered over his ears. If none of the staff happened to be near, they would punch him out. Why? No reason. Except that maybe in the vast white class of victims, there are subclasses, the victims of victims. He stopped wanting to communicate, and when that happened, the thinking process itself began to rust and disintegrate. He began to wander from place to place vacantly, looking at the nameless things that filled the world. He watched groups of children in the play yard move their lips, raise and lower their teeth like white drawbridges, dance their tongues in the ritual mating of speech. He sometimes found himself looking at a single cloud for as long as an hour at a time. Then Rudy had come, a big man with scars on his face and a bald head. 6 feet, 5 inches tall, might as well have been 20 to runty Nick Andros. They met for the first time in a basement room where there was a table, 6 or 7 chairs, and a TV that only workmen had felt like it. Rudy squatted, putting his eyes on approximately the same level as Nick's. Then he took his huge, scarred hands and put them over his mouth, his ears. I am a deaf mute. Nick turned his face sullenly away. Who gives a fuck? Rudy slapped him. Nick fell down. His mouth opened and silent tears began to leak from his eyes. He didn't want to be here with this scarred troll, this boogie. He was no deaf-mute. It was a cruel joke. Rudy pulled him gently to his feet and led him to the table. A blank sheet of paper was there. Rudy pointed at it, then at Nick. Nick stared back sullenly and shook his head. Rudy nodded and pointed at the empty paper again. He produced a pencil and handed it to Nick. Nick put it down as if it were hot. He shook his head. Rudy pointed at the pencil, then at Nick, then at the paper. Nick shook his head. Rudy slapped him again. More silent tears. The scarred face looking at him with nothing but deadly patience. Rudy pointed at the paper again, at the pencil, at Nick. Nick grasped the pencil in his fist. He wrote the 4 words that he knew, calling them forth from the cobwebby, rusting mechanism that was his thinking brain. He wrote, Nicholas Andros, fuck you. Then he broke the pencil in half and looked sullenly and defiantly at Rudy. But Rudy was smiling. Suddenly, he reached across the table and held Nick's head steady between his hard, calloused palms. His hands were warm, gentle. Nick could not remember the last time he had been touched with such love. His mother had touched him like that. Rudy removed his hands from Nick's face. He picked up the half of the pencil with the point on it. He turned the paper over to the blank side. He tapped the empty white space with the tip of the pencil and then tapped Nick. He did it again and again. And suddenly, Nick understood. You are this blank page. Nick began to cry. Rudy came for the next 6 years, where I learned to read and write. A man named Rudy Sparkman came to help me. I was very lucky to have him. In 1974, the orphanage went broke. They placed as many kids as they could, but I was not one of them. They said I would get placed with a family and the state would pay them for keeping me. I wanted to go with Rudy, but Rudy was in Africa working for the Peace Corps. So I ran away. Being 16, I don't think they looked for me too hard. I figured if I could stay out of trouble, I would be all right. And so far, so good. I've been taking the high school correspondence courses one at a time because Rudy always said education is the most important. When I settle down for a while, I'm going to take that high school equivalency test. I will be able to pass it soon. I like school. Maybe I will go to college someday. Well, that's my story. On the morning of June 22nd, yesterday, Baker came in around 7:30 while Nick was emptying waste baskets. The sheriff looked better. How you feeling? Nick wrote. Pretty good. I was burning up until midnight. Worst fever I've had since I was a kid. Aspirin didn't seem to help it. Janie wanted to call the doc, but around 12:30 the fever just broke. I slept like a log after that. How you doing? Nick made a thumb and forefinger circle. How's our guests? Nick opened and closed his mouth several times in a mime jabbering. Looked furious, made banging gestures on invisible bars. Baker threw back his head and laughed, then sneezed several times. You ought to be on TV, he said. Did you write your life story down like you said you was gonna? Nick nodded and handed the 2 sheets of longhand over. The sheriff sat down at his desk and read them carefully. When he was done, he looked at Nick so long and so piercingly that Nick stared down at his feet for a moment, embarrassed and confused. When he looked up again, Baker said, "You've been on your own since you were 16? For 6 years?" Nick nodded. "And you've really taken all these high school courses?" Nick wrote for some time on one of the memo sheets. "I was way behind because I started to read and write so late. When the orphanage closed, I was just starting to catch up. I got 6 HS credits from there, and another 6 since then from LaSalle in Chicago. I need 4 more credits." "What courses do you still need?" Baker asked. Nick wrote, "Geometry, advanced math, 2 years of a language. Those are the college requirements." "A language? You mean like French, German, Spanish?" Nick nodded. Baker laughed and shook his head. "Don't that beat all? A deaf mute learning to talk a foreign language. Nothing against you, boy. You understand that." Nick smiled and nodded. "So why you been drifting around so much?" "While I was still a minor, I didn't dare stay in one place for too long," Nick wrote. "Afraid they'd try to stick me in another orphanage or something. When I got old enough to look for a steady job, times got worse."
"Most places would just let you ramble on," Baker said. "In hard times, the milk of human kindness don't flow so free, Nick. I might be able to put you onto something around here, unless those boys soured you on Shoyo in Arkansas for good. But we ain't all like that." Nick nodded to show he understood that. "How's your teeth?" Nick shrugged. "Take any of those pain pills?" Nick held up 2 fingers. "Well, look. I got some paperwork to do on those boys. You go with what you're doing. We'll talk some more later." Dr. Soames, the man who had almost hit Nick with his car, came by around 9:30 a.m. that same morning. He was a man of about 60 with shaggy white hair and a scrawny chicken neck and very sharp blue eyes.
"Big John tells me you read lips," he said. "He also says he wants to see you gainfully employed. So I guess I better make sure you're not going to die on his hands. Take off your shirt."
Nick unbuttoned his blue work shirt and took it off.
"Holy Jesus, look at him," Baker said. "They worked him over pretty good, all right."
Soames looked at Nick and said dryly,
"Boy, you almost lost your left tit."
He pointed to a crescent-shaped scab just above the nipple. Nick's belly and rib cage looked like a Canadian sunrise. Soames poked and prodded him and looked carefully into the pupils of his eyes. At last he examined the shattered remains of Nick's front teeth, the only part of him that really hurt now, in spite of the spectacular bruises.
"That must have hurt like a son of a bitch," he said, and Nick nodded ruefully. "You're gonna lose him," Soames went on. "You..."
He sneezed 3 times in quick succession.
"Excuse me."
He began to put his tools back into his black bag.
"The prognosis is favorable, young man, barring strokes of lightning or further trips to Zach's gin mill. Is your speaking problem physical, or does it come from being deaf?"
Nick wrote, "No vocal cords, no eardrums." Soames nodded.
"Classic birth defects. It's a shame. Thank God that he didn't decide to give your brains a stir while he was at it. Put your shirt on."
Nick did. He liked Soames. In his way, he was very much like Rudy Sparkman, who told him once that God had given all deaf-mute males an extra 2 inches below the waist to make up for what he had taken away above the collarbones. Soames said,
"I'll tell him to give you a refill on that pain medication down at the drugstore. Tell Moneybags here to pay for it."
"Ho, ho," John Baker said.
"He's got more dough stashed away in fruit jars than a hog has warts,"
Soames went on. He sneezed again, wiped his nose, rummaged around in his bag, and brought out a stethoscope.
"You won't look out, Gramps. I'll lock you up for drunk and disorderly," Baker said with a smile.
"Yeah, yeah, yeah," Soames said.
"You'll open your mouth too wide one day and fall right in. Take off your shirt, John, and let's see if your boobs are as big as they used to be."
"Take off my shirt? Why?"
Because your wife wants me to look at you, that's why. She thinks you're a sick man, and she doesn't want you to get any sicker. God knows why. Ain't I told her enough times that she and I wouldn't have to sneak around anymore if you were underground? Come on, Johnny, strip it off. It was just a cold, Baker said, reluctantly unbuttoning his shirt. I feel fine this morning. Honest to God, Ambrose, you sound worse than I do. You don't tell the doctor tells you, Soames said. As Baker pulled his shirt off, Soames turned to Nick and said, But you know it's funny how a cold will just start making the rounds. Mrs. Lathrop is down sick, and the whole Ritchie family, and most of those no-accounts out on the Barker Road are coughing their brains out. Even that Billy Warner in there. Baker had wormed out of his undershirt. They're what I tell you, Soames said conversationally. Hasn't he got a set? Even an old shit like me could get horny looking at that. Baker gasped as the stethoscope touched his chest. Jesus, that's cold. What do? Keep it in a deep freeze? Breathe in, Soames said, frowning. Let it out. Baker let it out, and his exhale turned into a weak cough. Soames kept at the sheriff's fingers of his right hand into the flesh of Baker's neck under the jaw. Baker winced away from it. I don't have to ask if that hurt, Soames said. John, go home and go to bed. Baker blinked. Am, he said quietly, you know I can't do that. I've got three prisoners who have to go up to Camden this afternoon. I left this kid with him last night, but I won't do it again. He's mute. I wouldn't have agreed to it last night if I'd been thinking right. You've got some kind of respiratory infection, a damn good one by the sound, and a fever. Your pipes are sick, Johnny. And to be perfectly frank, that's no joke for a man who's carrying around the extra meat you are. Go to bed. If you still feel okay tomorrow morning, get rid of them then. Better still, call the state patrol to come down and get them. Baker looked apologetically at Nick. You know, he said, I do feel kind of dragged out. Maybe some rest. Go home and lie down, Nick wrote. I'll be careful. Besides, I have to earn enough to pay for those pills. Nobody works so hard for you as a junkie, Soames said, and burst out laughing. Baker picked up the two sheets of paper with Nick's background on them. Could I take these home for Janie to read? She took a real shine to you, Nick. Nick scrawled on the pad, Sure can. She's very nice. One of a kind, Baker said, and sighed as he buttoned his shirt back up. This fever's coming on strong again. Thought I had it licked. Take aspirin, Soames said, latching his bag. It's that glandular infection I don't like. There's a cigar box in the bottom desk drawer, Baker said. It's petty cash. You can go out for lunch and get your medication on the way. Those boys aren't what I'd call desperados. Just leave a voucher for how much you take. I'll get in touch with the state police, and you'll be shut of them by late this afternoon. Nick made a thumb and forefinger circle. I've been trusting you a lot on short notice, Baker said soberly. But Janie says it's all right. You have a care. Nick nodded. Jane Baker came in around 6 yesterday evening with a covered dish supper and a carton of milk. Nick wrote, Thanks very much. How's your husband? She laughed, a small woman with chestnut brown hair, dressed prettily in a checked shirt and faded jeans. He wanted to come down himself, but I talked him out of it. His fever was up so high this afternoon that it scared me, but it's almost down to normal tonight. I think it's because of the state patrol. Johnny's never really happy unless he can be mad at the state patrol. Nick looked at her quizzically. They told him they couldn't send anybody down for his prisoners until 9 tomorrow morning. They've had a bad sick day, 20 or more troopers out. And a lot of the people who are on have been fetching people up to the hospital at Camden or even Pine Bluff. There's a lot of this sickness around. I think Am Soames is a lot more worried than he's letting on. She looked worried herself. Then she took the two folded sheets of memo paper from her breast pocket. This is quite a story, she said quietly, handing the papers back to him. You've had just about the worst luck of anybody I ever heard of. I think the way you've risen above your handicaps is admirable.
and I have to apologize again for my brother. Nick, embarrassed, could only shrug. I hope you'll stay on and show you, she said, standing. My husband likes you, and I do too. Be careful of those men in there. I will, Nick wrote. Tell the sheriff I hope he feels better. I'll take him your good wishes. She left then, and Nick passed a night of broken rest, getting up occasionally to check on his three wards. He dreamed oddly, and all he could remember upon waking was that he seemed to have been walking through endless rows of green corn, looking for something, and terribly afraid of something else that seemed to be behind him.